agenda today with a work session on House Bill 2811, and we are honored with the presence of Representative Olson, who is entitled to bring up anyone else you want after we hear from counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2811A would expand the types of equipment or devices that may not be used in a car while it's being driven if those devices display broadcast television images or DVD players capable of displaying a video image if that equipment is located within the view of the driver's seat. The Dash A10 amendment that needs to be considered by the committee today clarifies that those prohibitions do not apply to emergency vehicles or vehicles with the in-dash navigation systems.
Okay, Representative Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I have a special interest here. Nobody else knows this other than maybe Mark, but 2811 happened to be my radio number when I was the first sergeant down at Cottage Grove office.
Did you request this number?
No. I just all of a sudden realized that this is 2811.
Well, that's very fortuitous. It must be a very good bill.
Oh, yeah. Anyways, my name is Andy Olson. I'm a representative out of House District 15, and I appreciate this opportunity to share in front of you today. The whole idea behind House Bill 2811 is pretty simple. The statute that exists currently, ORS 815.240, talks specifically about television screens located inside of the driver from the shoulder forward. We've had problems with that, and you can guess with the technology that we have today, there's a lot of other issues. The Dash A10 amendments address all the concerns that we have, specifically exemptions for emergency vehicles with the technology that they experience today, as well as some of the other display imaging that motor vehicles are receiving too. Our main target was specifically TVs and DVD players.
And you're looking at the A10 amendments, okay? Are there questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to committee, and thank you for coming back after we rescheduled this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landau with the Office of Government Relations. With me today is Lieutenant Vince Jarmer with the Portland Police Bureau's Traffic Division. Just very briefly, in the interest of time, as Representative Olson outlined, the current statute does speak to televisions in view of a driver while they're operating a motor vehicle. The technology has gotten to the point where DVD players can be placed on a person's a dashboard, and a police officer and watch a movie while they're driving down the highway, and essentially an officer would be powerless to do anything about it. We're just simply trying to bring the current statute up to date. We have, as Representative Olson mentioned, provided a few narrow exemptions, and we hope that the committee will look favorably on the A10 amendments, and I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions. And again, Lieutenant Jarmer here would be happy to answer any of your questions as well.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Landauer? Would you like to introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Vince Jarmer. I'm the Lieutenant of the Traffic Division, as Mark's already told you, for the Portland Police Bureau. It's a pleasure to be down here and address the committee. I really don't have anything to add except for the fact that we do recognize it as a driving distracted problem. And as Mark testified, all things being equal and other laws are not being broken, we're pretty much powerless to take care of a problem that we can see as somebody's driving down the road. And it's especially helpful at night to be able to see it because you can see the glow of the screen. Other than that, I just really feel that this is an update, kind of a technological update to an already existing law, and just would ask the committee to see fit to push this on ahead. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, I think Senator Walker?
I had concerns about this bill. The reason I had concerns is Mr. Landau came to see me the other day and talked about this bill, and I said, well, but you can't ticket some woman putting her makeup on driving down the road, or somebody reading your newspaper, or someone eating a hot dog. And I thought, you can already, it says in the testimony here that you can already cite someone for the offense of reckless driving. But then in the next paragraph you say that if they're obeying all the laws, you can't cite them. Is that your concern here? Anybody there can answer me.
Well, Representative, I'll take a shot at that. An officer.
Well, you have to start with Senator, not Representative.
I apologize. My apologies. Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, excuse me.
That's okay. You and I got to know each other over in the House.
Yes, we have. I would just note that before an officer could pull an individual over for either careless or reckless driving, the officer must observe a number of different violations in order to make that pullover. What we're trying to get at here is an officer, all things being equal, if a driver is obeying all the traffic laws at that time and sees somebody with a, for example, a DVD player sitting on their on their dashboard, again, the officer is powerless to do anything. That officer would actually have to wait for a driver to commit some type of an offense before he or she could pull that driver over, at which time he could certainly or she could certainly cite that individual for the violation for which he pulled that person over. But again, he could not or she could not do anything about that DVD player sitting on the dashboard. He could simply suggest that it's probably wise to put it away, but there is no enforcement mechanism for that officer to use in order to get that behavior changed.
My next question, Madam Chair, is what if the passenger in the front seat is watching the DVD player?
Well,
and not the driver?
Existing, that's a very good question. Existing law basically at this point says any screen that is visible to the driver and forward of the back of the driver's seat. Because of technological changes, we are limiting this really to just screens that are viewable to the driver. We've just become aware by the auto manufacturers that they are producing an onboard dash screen that from the driver's angle of viewing, they can watch a navigation system, which is a pretty commonplace in newer model vehicles these
mm-hmm.
days, while the passenger at the angle they're sitting in the vehicle can watch, and I'm going to use my children's favorite movie at the moment, Finding Nemo. It's a screen, a single screen that depending on the angle you're viewing will show two different images. So the technology is changing in such a rapid way that we've had to change the premise of what the current law says to really focus it in on the driver who's operating the vehicle rather than the passenger, because we anticipate that with these technological changes there are going to be more things that can be available to the passenger of a vehicle. And we think that's in keeping with the spirit of the original law, that drivers shouldn't be watching television as they're driving down the road.
Well, no, Chair, I don't argue with that at all. And then I see on the front page you've defined what an image display device is, so you would not capture these new display screens that are in vehicles like in the hybrid vehicles.
No.
You can become captivated by watching those things do all their machinations, but this bill does not address those. The other issue I was concerned about, sometimes I'm sitting in the passenger seat of the car, it's rare, but my husband will drive and I'll be working on my laptop. So the laptop is visible to the driver, but this would say it's equipment capable of displaying a broadcasted television image or a DVD capable of displaying a visual image. So there I need to ask you that question. If I'm working on my laptop, he can see that. Is that excluded from the bill?
Well, Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, in most laws, officers do have some discretion. I would imagine that if an officer were to pull a driver over for the reason that you outlined. If the screen was not actually playing a DVD at that time, he or she may very well be reluctant to issue a citation. I would suspect that in that case, the officer would suggest that perhaps the screen should be oriented in a fashion that may that would not be a distraction to the driver in that case. You know, again, this really, we hope, is not going to be used to generate citations. It's really an opportunity to remind people that that's a dangerous behavior. It's probably wise to put it away. And I would imagine that in most instances, a driver would comply and the screen would be oriented or turned off in a manner that wouldn't be visible to the driver.
Senator Walker, are you done with your questions?
I'm just still concerned about that scenario, Madam Chair. Did Representative Olson testify? Did you testify?
Yes.
I'm sure at the very beginning.
Oh, I was in a conference with Senator Ringo. I'm sorry, I missed it.
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, that it's in subsection 2, and it's line 13, motor vehicle equipped.
Oh, well, what does the word equip mean?
I mean, it means that it's attached, physically attached. That was my understanding always, even as I was a trooper out on the road for 29 years, so.
Okay.
Senator Ringo.
I thought that there was a violation for either improper driving or inattentive driving, but I'm looking in the vehicle code. I don't see it.
Are you thinking, Sherberg? Yeah. You're thinking of driving unencumbered?
Yes.
Is that what you're thinking? You're driving encumbered. That was a statute that existed several years ago and was removed because it was abused.
I see. I think I got a ticket once for improper driving, but it wasn't in Oregon. So.
And actually, that would address your concern to some degree, too, Senator Walker, about, you know, the person who's down there with the razor shaving or the lady who's putting on the makeup or something like that, and their movement, I don't think would constitute specifically maybe careless driving or reckless driving, but that's the only violations that would exist that would apply to that. Driving while encumbered would fit that movement. And we no longer have that statute.
It was, Madam Chair, if I could follow up, it was abused in what way? You said that the statute was removed because it was abused.
A lot of it, what had occurred, there was some testimony years ago. The people, they were driving down the road and they had their little dogs up on there.
Sure.
Looking out the window and everything like that. And they would receive citations as a result of that for it being an encumbered situation.
The doggy ticket.
Try traveling with cats.
Thank you.
This committee is a little bizarre sometimes.
Representative Olson, you just confused me because Mark testified that, or one of you stated you're trying to get at the DVD player sitting on the dashboard. Mm-hmm. That then you said. Motor vehicle equipped with any means it has to be attached. So does that mean that this bill isn't doing what you want it to do?
Well, I could certainly attempt to address that. Oftentimes these computers or DVDs have cigarette lighter attachment mm-hmm. for a power source. I would imagine that could be considered as equipped because the power source is being drawn from the vehicle. In that instance, if it's freestanding sitting on the dashboard, you know, the whole notion of equipped is the current law. We didn't want to necessarily change that. Again, this is an attempt to give the officers an opportunity to just remind people that don't do this. And whether it's equipped or not, it, you know, certainly makes a difference whether or not they're going to issue a citation, but that's the one distinction that we did leave into the bill, was the equipped.
Chair Burdick and Senator Breyer, I can only speak from my experience from what I recall years ago when I used to work the road in this situation. If a person had a television screen forward of the seat behind them, I felt that they were subject to a citation and that they were in violation of the law, even though what equipped was... To my understanding of this, you know, obviously there's going to be probably some discretion left to the judge regarding this issue too. But again, the main focus that we're trying to do with this is to focus specifically television screens and the DVD players, and as Mark had mentioned, the technology is so fast, it's incredible. I mean, even to watching TV now, some commercials with your cell phones can receive, mm-hmm. you know, movies on them and everything like that. Does that apply to this? Well, I don't think that falls under equipped. But we're just trying to gain some control here through this bill and give a tool for the officers to deal with this.
I'd like to ask counsel for guidance, because I don't necessarily, the way this is phrased in the A-10 Amendment, I don't see the notion of equipped as necessarily having to be from the factory. I mean, if you put a television set up on your dashboard and plug it in, I mean, I don't see this ruling it out. Counsel, can you provide any guidance on that? Because equipment would clearly apply to anything, whether it came from the factory or not.
Senator Burdick and members of the committee, I would tend to agree, actually, and I'm noting that in several versions of the A-10 amendments, the use of the word equipment even is removed, and simply it just says that if they use an image display device as opposed to the equipment piece. What I would want to probably look at the traffic code in general to see if that's, if equipment is defined somewhere else, and I'd be happy to do that here while we're continuing to discuss this. But my general sense would be, you know, certainly if it was, I mean, my guess is probably along the lines of what Mr. Landauer and Representative Olson have said, which is there would be a certain amount of officer discretion as well as judicial discretion, and I think really the issue would be how a particular item was being used, so that if, you know, under Senator Walker's hypothetical, she is looking at the screen of her laptop and she is working on the screen of her laptop, even if, you know, the driver of the vehicle can crane their neck and see the screen of the laptop, I would believe that an officer is not going to cite under those circumstances. If, on the other hand, the laptop is playing a DVD and it's shifted on the passenger seat so that both driver and passenger are watching the movie together while the driver drives down the highway, I would think that would be a citable offense, and I think it would probably be a discretionary issue.
I'd also point out, Mr. Russell just pointed out on line 17 of the first page on the amendment, an image display device that is displaying a broadcast television image or visual image from a digital video disc or video cassette player. I think that may get at Senator Walker's question about the laptop as well.
I don't know about your laptop, but my laptop, if it's over here and you're looking at it from the side, you can't see the screen.
Exactly.
That's true. Some laptops, however, have DVD players in them. Mine's an older one and it doesn't. But I think that given judicial discretion and some of these other issues, it's probably fine, because I think it's absolutely ridiculous that people can drive down the road and watch a movie. I mean, I like to multitask too, but that takes it to the absurd. Mr. Lander, do you get a lot of these cases in the Portland area? Is that why you're behind us here?
I would like to defer to Lieutenant Jarmer on that, if I may, Senator.
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker. No, we don't get a lot, but we get a fair number, and we usually are there in the aftermath of a rear-ender or somebody running up over a sidewalk or something like that, causing quite a hazard. But a lot, no.
Okay.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Okay, committee, I think I may have said we're in work, that we've actually been in public hearing, and I will close the public hearing. The chair likes this bill a lot.
Well, Madam Chair, I see your name on it. That might have something to do with it.
Loves this bill. And if Senator Starr loves this bill, we might actually do something. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2811.
Move the dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2811.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 10 amendment to House Bill 2811. Any discussion?
Well, how come it took you so long to get, you took 10 amendments to get this bill?
Well, you know, these things take work, Senator Walker. You know, you heard the questioning. Any objections?
No, I just wanted to get a little dig at you.
So, this committee's getting rummy. We better watch out.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2811 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2811 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Good bill should pass, but for the record, I would like to make sure that whoever carries this bill, and I assume it would be you, would lay a record that the committee discussed at length, and a motor vehicle equipped with an image displaying device would include an image displaying device that is plugged into a cigarette lighter. So, Supreme Court and Appeals Court, if you are listening.
And Senator Beyer, I may even branch out, a non-technological person that I am, to say that if you had a laptop that was had some other power source and was playing a DVD, it would be certainly intended to apply to that as well. We're there to drive, not entertain ourselves, right, committee?
Except when I'm a passenger and then I get work done, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill. Thank you. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3352. I see Mr. Representative Butler in the audience. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 3352 provides that a descendant surviving parent may not inherit by intestacy if the parent deserted and neglected the child for a period of 10 years or more before the decedent attained 18 years of age, or if the decedent died before attaining 18 years of age and the parent deserted or neglected the child during the life of the decedent. You have before you dash A5 amendments. Those amendments make several changes. They're mostly technical to make the bill more more workable for practitioners. They're not intended to change the substance of the bill. Specifically, they changed the no support standard to desertion and willful neglect. That standard is mirrors ORS 109.324, which has had extensive judicial construction, so it's meant to use a term that's defined, so it's a little bit more understandable what the difference is between no support, or instead of using a term that's undefined, such as no support. Those amendments also provide that subject to states pass if the deserting parent predeceased the decedent. They authorize the court to disregard incidental visitations, communications, or contributions in determining desertion or willful neglect. They also require persons who would benefit by the forfeiture of the parent's share to file a petition in order to claim the share, and they set out procedural requirements that they must follow, and require persons to prove desertion or neglect by clear and convincing evidence. And they also delete references to heirs and devisees so that only the share to the deserting parent is lost.
Okay, thank you, Representative Butler. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. Staff has done an excellent job bringing up to date with the A5 amendment, which is the latest iteration. Again, this had been thoroughly vetted previously with Chris Klein of the Oregon Bar Association and the intestacy work that he's been doing, and then later was updated by one, Darris, an attorney who has a great deal of practice in this particular area of intestacy. And
we love Warren Darris.
Yes, Warren Darris is a favorite in this committee.
If you had brought him today, your bill would have just passed like that.
Okay.
Give your name for the record, so
I'm sorry,
you take care of that detail. I appreciate it.
Representing Tom Butler, House District 60, and I beg your pardon. I stampede to apologize. And so with the A5, as staff has indicated, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that it brings the no support standard, and it brings all of the issues back into a focus. And that's what we're trying to do, is make sure that you can't get large animals to jump through this, that we just take care of the issues at hand. And I think that this is an excellent revision, and I fully support it, would encourage your support. And I vote for the A5 amendments to House Bill 3352 that moved to the Senate with a due pass.
Thank you very much. I think we could call this the deadbeat parent comes back to get rich scheme being foiled here. Is that correct?
And yes, Madam Chair, the specific case here involved was a child who was damaged at birth and was able to accumulate through a settlement. In the conservatorship, they actually have a home and a small amount of resources, and the mother has stayed home, has taken care of the child her entire life. We've set some aside through the conservatorship to provide for a small retirement fund for her, but she doesn't even have Social Security credits built up at this particular point. The difficulty would be that through the present laws of intestacy, we would have to go back and find the deadbeat dad who's been out of the lives of the family for over 20 years, and certainly since this child was damaged in the hospital at age approximately 3, and then the mother would lose the home, and it would be a very difficult situation. And so we tried to pattern it down to the fact pattern that then I'm told that this is happening more and more, that we do have deadbeat parents that will come back and say, wait a minute, there's been something accumulated, or a right to a book, or those kinds of things, and then they want to share in the estate. So I certainly would appreciate anything we can do to continue to work down this vein to see what we can do about precluding these deadbeat parents from coming back and trying to claim even a small inheritance from the deceased.
Appreciate that. Thank you for bringing this to us. And any questions from the committee? Senator Beyer. Thank
you. Representative or counsel, I don't know who would be the more appropriate person to ask for the question, but if this goes into effect and there is a child who only has one parent who happens to be a deadbeat parent, where would the inheritance go to then?
Council, maybe you could address that.
I'll address that one. Representative Beyer, or sorry, Senator Beyer.
Not near as touchy as Senator Walker.
You know, it's an affliction this morning.
It
or
is.
This afternoon. This committee.
Senator Beyer.
Senator Walker.
The succession would govern how that property would pass if an individual did not have parents. I would need to look it up, but it would just go to the next line. I think it would be your siblings or grandparents, and it would continue on down the line.
Okay, thank you. That was my understanding also. But my next question, or the follow-up question, would be if we are going to cut off or limit people who had no contact, i.e. a parent, why would we not make the same limit or restriction on a more distant relative if they also had no contact? Say, for instance, you had a child, only one parent, no siblings, no parent, no grandparents on the other side, but his parents would be the next in line, is my understanding. So you've got a dad who's cut off, and you've got his parents. If they've had no nexus to the child or no contact with the child for the same length of time, why would we then benefit them? Why would you make it one more step removed?
No. Madam Chair, if I can address the concerns that Representative Beyer may have.
He's actually a senator.
Senator Beyer.
You have to be a senator to be on Senate Judiciary. Yeah. That's a requirement.
If I can address Senator Beyer's concerns. Typically, if you have none of those folks involved in the life of this particular child, then that child's going to be awarded the state, and there isn't going to be any estate involved here. What we have here is a mother who stayed home and took care of, and if it had been a brother and the mother and father were both either dead or out of the child's life under these circumstances, then it would be through the laws of intestacy, it would fall to the brother or the other family members that had stayed and taken care of that particular child. But typically the case in the day's world and the day that we live in, that child would be then relegated to the state care and be in the care of the state. There wouldn't be an estate involved typically.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate that explanation, but I can, and in the case you're speaking of, you're familiar with that as the case, but I can foresee a case where you've got a potential wealthy mother who has a child. The father's long since been gone. Something happens to her, she dies, the child inherits, still a minor. And then something happens to the child, the father's been gone, the grandfather's, the parents are gone, this child dies at a later time. Let's say it's an auto accident, the mother dies first, 24 hours later the child dies. In that case, you've then got the inheritance, and it could be a large inheritance, going to a grandparent who is more distantly removed than the deadbeat dad. I guess my question would be, if you're going to restrict the deadbeat dad from inheriting, why would you not restrict all family members who don't have a nexus to the child or to the person?
No.
And Madam Chair, if I may, again, Senator Beyer's concern, this involves, first of all, the child will have attained age 18 or older. So this child would have been emancipated and would, under the fact situation in this particular law, the child never had the capacity or lacked the capacity to have prepared a will during this particular time. And it's only just at that point, if no family is involved, whether it be brothers, sisters, or parents are all deceased or deadbeat, then at that particular point, then the laws of intestacy really do need to kick in. And this, while this doesn't address every fact situation, it does address the fact situations where you have parents who have abrogated their responsibility, and in this particular instance have actually fulfilled the requirement, as staff has indicated, of the no support standard of a deserting and willful neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sufficient standard to address the concerns that we have relative to the moving one person out, one family member, one parent who had that obligation into the laws, out of the intestate succession.
Yeah.
Out of the chain of succession.
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, I think Representative Butler gave a very good explanation there, because the bill says that the parent deserts the decedent, and the parent neglected without just and sufficient cause to provide proper care and maintenance. It is not the responsibility of a brother or sister or grandparent to provide those things to the child. It is the parent's responsibility, and so it should be the parent who is the one who does not get to reap the rewards, so to speak, should the child die before they're 18. I think you get into all sorts of complicated issues about well, the grandparent hasn't called in 10 years, so that they must not be connected to the child, or maybe there's a sibling that was born out of wedlock or in wedlock that went somewhere else and nobody knew about the long-lost sister or brother. So I think it's justifiable when you limit it to the parent that's their responsibility. When you give birth to a child, it's your responsibility to take care of that child.
Well, that's true, too, but I think what you're trying to deal with is the eventuality that the child dies, and normally speaking, mm-hmm. when the child dies, the normal succession would be the estate is divided between both parents. Now, you've mm-hmm. got one parent alive, so the rest of the people in succession is not relevant, because if you have one parent alive and the other parent is a deadbeat, then it would all go to the one parent. Now, if the one parent was already dead and the deadbeat came in for the money and the child died, then it would go through the normal
the laws of intestacy, and that way there would be it would continue in the laws of intestacy with the succession of whatever the succession is as to the brothers, sisters, parent or grandparents at that point.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
Senator Pazansky.
I'm sorry I was late for this one. I'm just wondering if there's any discussion as to how do you define desert and how is it proven?
Council, you want to address that?
Senator Pazansky, I mentioned earlier that term was added at the suggestion of Mr. Darris, and I think he was working with Mr. Gibb as well. They took those terms from ORS 109-324, and apparently there is extensive judicial construction regarding those terms. That's a statute that's relating to adoption, and it uses those standards.
That's fine, Madam Chair. The only thing I would say is if it's coming from a different section, we may want to have some references to what we're relying on, because at some point there's going to be a proof issue here of 10 years, and we're going to have to make certain that it actually has enough construction for the court to follow. And I don't know, based on reference to a section that's not within the section that we're talking about, if it needs to be defined or not as to referenced.
Counsel?
That is a good point. It's a standalone section. It's not making reference to this section. So if the committee wanted to further define that or make a reference to that section, that would add further clarification to how those terms were to be defined.
That actually might be a good further protection to put that in if we do have judicial construction of that other sentence, of that other section. The problem we have is we're running a little short on time, so I'm wondering if we could get something done by Thursday to take up at our last meeting. It would probably be
Madam Chair, I would think so, because that deserted and willful neglect parent construction is found in the code, and certainly that could be referenced in the A5 and come up with a new amendment.
As defined by section.
Yeah, as defined by the.
Okay.
And I didn't get the exact, but staff will certainly know.
Okay, I think we know what we want to do. If you'd work with staff on that, and we'll bring it back Thursday.
Certainly do that. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 3352 and open a hearing on House Bill 2282. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2282, the A engrossed version itself clarifies three separate areas of law, criminal and violation citations in sections 1-3. Essentially, the form used to say reasonable grounds for violation and traffic or violation and criminal citations. But in the case of at least criminal charges, the standard is probable cause. So the phrase sufficient grounds was used on the original citation forms, thinking that that would prevent confusion. However, the statutes themselves didn't get changed, so only the form has changed. And so this would change the statutes as well. Sections 4-12 address the definition of in person, and that is to allow for simultaneous television transmissions of a defendant's appearance when certain conditions are met. The bill clarifies that simultaneous television transmissions can be utilized in situations beyond an arraignment and pleas of not guilty, to include when a defendant wishes to change their plea to guilty or no contest. And finally, Section 7 adds language so that criminal money judgments contain the same language as civil money judgments, clarifying that other judgment remedies can be used when a criminal money judgment is awarded. There are a few amendments that have occurred since this came over. The Dash A3 amendment is a clarification as to certain appearances by electronic transmission. It is before the committee at the request of OCDLA. It has no... I don't think anyone is opposed to that. It's a very simple fix. The second amendment would allow for electronic citations in criminal cases. We already do this or have the ability by statute to do this in violation and traffic citations. This would enable officers to do it for criminal citations as well. There are two amendments, the Dash A4 and the Dash A6 amendments, that deal with this issue. The Dash A4 amendments amends the existing statute in the violations chapter of the Oregon Revised Statutes. However, Legislative Council did those amendments and then expressed some concern to me that by amending that violations chapter, you would have potential crossover and definition problems, and that it didn't fit very well since this is a criminal case as opposed to a violation case. So the A6 amends the criminal citations chapter, chapter 133, and is certainly Legislative Council's preferred version. And just my general experience, although I understand the concern of having mirrored statutes, means that when a change is made to one, you know, we have to rely on LC to catch that second mirror statute as well. And I know that's a concern, but my opinion, for what that's worth, the A6 amendments are, I think, a little bit cleaner because it's in, I think, a more appropriate statutory chapter.
Thank you very much. We'll start out with Mr. Landauer, Mr. Jarman again.
Madam Chair, we also have a Dash A5. Perfect. Is that...
You know, the Dash A5, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that that had been handed out to the committee. That had a few minor changes that were made by the Dash A6, so I would say that the A4 and the A6 would be the two that the committee would have to decide whether to amend that violations chapter or the criminal citation chapter, but the A5 would have also amended the criminal citation chapter but missed an emergency clause. The A6 does the emergency clause and a few other real little technical things and is the preferred version.
Thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, Mark Landau with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. Ms. Moad has done a fine job describing the A6 amendment. Simply put, the Oregon Judicial Department is currently working on a rule to allow for the electronic filing of violations to courts. This amendment would simply expand that authority narrowly to criminal citations as well. This is for us an efficiency issue, not only for police officers but also for the court. And Lieutenant Vince Jarmer here can briefly describe for you some of the efficiencies that we can anticipate as a result of passage of this amendment and hopefully the adoption of a rule by the Judicial Department.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Pruszynski.
Mark, you said narrowly modify. Can you
I apologize. Well, narrowly expand the existing authority of the Judicial Department to include criminal citations in the rule that they're working on presently that will allow for the electronic filing of violation citations.
Right.
So in other words, they're currently working on a rule that will permit the filing of violations electronically to the court. This amendment will expand on that authority to also allow for the electronic filing of criminal citations, for example, DUI or reckless driving.
But not just a limited number of criminal, all criminal citations that can be issued, correct?
Here comes the expert.
I'm just trying to figure out what the parameter of this bill.
Join the party.
These are citable.
Right. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record. For the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. A couple of years ago, in 1996, we got authority put in the statutes because we were anticipating that police were going to want to move to what are called, commonly referred to as e-citations or electronic citations, where what they do is they have a handheld that prints a ticket on the site, and they give the ticket to the person who's being cited, but then when they get back, that plug it in to a stand and they download the electronics, and rather than filing a paper ticket with the court that's signed, what they do is they push a button and the information travels mystically through the wires to the courts and appears on our computer. And it saves them time, it saves us time for reentry. We now have, there was an ambiguity in the statute before. It was written in such a way that it wasn't clear that it could be used for any kind of citation that could, that you could use a uniform citation for. And as we have now two police agencies who are waiting for us to complete a rule that will allow this in our courts, they wanted to make sure they could do it for the driving under the influence, for the other misdemeanor traffic offenses and things that they might be citing, so they didn't have to be doing things in two different ways. So what the A6 amendment will do is clear up the ambiguity to make it clear that we have the authority to allow them to file these electronically without the signature, and there's maybe other modifications we need to make because it's not a piece of paper anymore, it's something else. But it still provides that people can have access to them if they want to come in and look at them, and there are other provisions in the A6. That's what this amendment's all about, and we're agreeable to this. We've been pushing for this and trying to do this for years because it helps officers spend less hang time on the highway where they're exposed to cars. Eventually, when we get to the point where not only do they not have to re-enter when they get to the office, but they file it with us electronically, we don't have to re-enter, and hopefully when we're done and all our systems are connected, it'll be shipped to DMV electronically, and DMV won't have to re-enter. So there's a potential for saving money all the way, but it's starting out in pilot projects now, which is why it's being amended. This issue came to us just a couple of weeks ago that there was an uncertainty about the ambiguity in the statute, and we feel it should be cleared up.
Can I ask a
question? Counsel.
Mr. Swank, when I was practicing in Multnomah County, we had two different kinds of sites. The Z site and the C site was what we called them. The Z sites were what officers would cite people on for all traffic violations as well as misdemeanor crimes. And then the C site was the felonies where an officer was citing and releasing for whatever reason. Does this dash A6 amendment deal with what would be considered the Z sites, would it be limited to misdemeanors? Do you know? I just don't know where the authority for those separate sites comes in. So,
Chair Burdick, Counsel Mowad, the Supreme Court adopts actually, and it's part of my day job. The Supreme Court adopts five different sites, and over the years we have worked to a point where officers can use one site to cite for any offense. And there are some specialty citations. There's something, and they can cite for a violation or they can cite for a misdemeanor, and there's some felonies that the officers can cite and release on. They can use that site too. Part of that depends upon the district attorney. Okay. The district attorney has to approve whether or not the citation includes a complaint, and so we have another specialty citation for those counties where the district attorney doesn't want the officers to be issuing the complaint directly, and there it's a notice to appear. And then we've got some for aeronautics and for boating and for parks and recreation but officers can use a single site if they want. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Senator Whitson.
Chair Burdick, Mr. Twank, how do you prevent people from hacking into your system?
Chair Burdick, Senator Whitson, we've actually been on Oregon. How to explain this? Oregon has had part of its state court system on the computer since they became state courts in the late 80s, and they weren't part of the counties. And in the early 90s, we brought everybody into OGIN, and we have an ITD division that helps set up firewalls and screen things that come in and set up the best protection we can afford. And so far, they've done a pretty good job of keeping people from being able to crack into OGIN.
Madam Chair, Ms. Schwenk, what prompted the question was that the Department of Education spent some $35 million to protect SimCam tests online, and some eighth graders arrived with them the other day.
Senator Burdick, Chair Whitsitt, interestingly enough, one of the reasons I think probably people don't try and hack into our computers as much as they might others is because most of what we have is public information. We actually sell a great deal of what is on our computers to people who want the information for things. So a lot of it's public. But to my knowledge, we haven't been successfully brought down from a hacker yet.
Mm-hmm. One further question. From a different angle, how would you detect it, and how would you address it if someone actually hacked into your system and started citing people?
Chair Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, I suppose it depends on how it was detected and what. I mean, there's such a variety of potential ways that people can get into computers and what they can do. It would depend upon how you detected it, what the hole was, if it were trackable. I mean, there are a lot of different potential things with that, but as a practical matter, we're pretty much committed to computers now. It's the paper system was we're moving away from it because it tended to be a little unwieldy. We handle a couple million cases come in every biennium, and we wouldn't be able to process them without the computers.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Welcome back, Lieutenant Jarman.
Yes, thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm pretty much technologically challenged.
Can identify you again.
My name is Vince Jarmer, and I'm the Lieutenant of Traffic Division, Portland Police Bureau. Having said that, I am still technologically challenged, pretty much like maybe a lot of people are. And this is a real step forward, a real step into the future, as it were, although I think we're playing a little catch-up even right now. As many of you probably unfortunately know, this is what a traffic citation looks like. And, of course, there's multiple. In this particular one, there's five different copies that have to go somewhere particular. And one of the things that I really like about this amendment is the fact that we can get all of this stuff to the right place instantaneously, practically, and with a minimal of problems. Obviously, we won't lose the paperwork if it's electronic, and the electronic storage issues, transmission issues have been, I'm not an IT guy, but I know that a lot of problems have been worked through and researched, and we're pretty secure. I hope that's comforting. To my way of thinking, it's a pretty secure system. I really view this as an efficiency move forward, and it's huge for us. As my colleague to the right had said, it really saves us time on the freeways, getting the citation issued to a person and getting them on their way. Not only freeways, but any street for that matter, but particularly in the Portland area, and I know out in the rural areas as well. If you're on the freeway and somebody's coming by at 60 miles an hour, it's very unnerving. You just want to get in there, get the citation written or whatever, and then get out. Obviously, another efficiency is the almost nil paperwork that goes on with this. The only piece of paper that's issued initially is to the traffic violator or the person who's under arrest. And the rest of it's electronically stored and sent to the appropriate recipient, and then they can generate the paperwork at their point that they need to have. And so we don't have the issue of going to a certain place and being photocopied and then moving on to three different places and them having to photocopy and what have you. It'll go directly there. I'm very impressed with some of the work that the people that I'm privileged enough to work with have been doing behind the scenes on getting these issues worked out. I just made some notes about the efficiency, and I just really can't say enough about that. So I think that my final comment would just be that we're going to save the courts some time. We're going to save the judges and the attorneys some time with this efficiency. Certainly us, and I think even the violators will be not held longer than they absolutely have to in order to do this. This stuff works really fast.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee?
for the panel or just for the lieutenant?
Either one.
Just for the record, understanding that this is going to be electronically submitted to the court and other areas, if there's somehow a loss of data, and I understand there's going to be all this backup, but if for some reason it's lost, I'm assuming that means that ticket goes away. Because there's not going to be any paper trail that you're going to be able to hold that person accountable if you lose that electronic data.
Chair Burdick, Senator.
Just talk me into it.
Chair Burdick, Senator Przanski, it is possible that data gets lost. If it doesn't show, I suppose it depends upon what's lost and what kind of record it is. I mean, it's a current problem that we sometimes have people showing up in courts with tickets that have been handed them to them by police officers and sometimes by people who aren't police officers, trying to pay off their tickets, and we have no record of it. And we either have to chase it down if it's identifiable. Sometimes what will happen is a ticket will be issued in the morning, and that person will drive right from where the ticket was given to them to court to try and pay it, and we'll look at it. And sometimes a ticket just never shows up. I mean, it happens. So, yes, we'll have to deal with that. And I just realized that I think what Senator Withes was asking was, how do we know it's them that's sending us the stuff electronically on the tickets? And we'll have to use, if I may, Chair Burdick, answer his question, because I think that's what you were asking before, correct?
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to set up codes so that we can identify them the same as you would on an email situation, so that you know that it's coming potentially from somebody who's approved to send you those kinds of tickets. These are things that are still to be worked out. We're in the baby stages. We're just crawling on this, and we're still having to set things up and work out practical issues so that we can make this happen.
But this is a pilot project at this point. Okay, I think we're going to cut off discussion on this and ask Kelly Skye if she would come up and briefly summarize the Dash 3 amendment that we have in front of us. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And the amendment is merely intended to clarify that the electronic appearance that's contemplated by the other portion of the bill is to apply for arraignments. Our concern is that a criminal defendant not be compelled to appear electronically against their will at a trial or a motion to suppress or hearing where their physical presence is necessary. And the Judicial Department agreed that that was their original intent and agreed to the amendment.
Thank you for that summary. Questions from the committee? Okay, we're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2282 and open a work session on House Bill 2282. Senator Starr, we have the Dash 3 and the Dash 6 amendments in front of us that we're working with today.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2282.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2282. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2282, Madam Chair.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 6 amendment to House Bill 2282. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Yes, Madam Chair. Move House Bill 2282 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2282 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection?
I'll support the bill, Madam Chair, but to follow up on Senator Przanski's point, it would be interesting to see what would happen to the system if an appropriate virus was introduced.
As long as they get rid of all my speeding tickets, I won't complain. This is a pilot program, and I think it's a good policy that we're doing here, and I hope it works. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We will have our resident traffic expert, Senator Przanski, carry this bill, if you're willing. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2323. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2323 changes the date by which a person sentenced as a dangerous offender must undergo a mental health examination. This bill would propose a 120-day window for the examination to occur, and that also provides the parole board time to review the report prior to the hearing. There are two statutes, each of which cite to a 60-day window, and my understanding is from hearing testimony the last time that those two statutes, when read together, have been occasionally interpreted to mean they have to both occur. The evaluation has to occur, and the report has to be reviewed by the parole board within that 60 days, and I believe what Mr. Washington will tell us is that's just not quite enough time. So,
thank you. Mr. Washington, you have been very patient on this bill. Welcome to the committee.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
I just did not have House Bill 2323 in my file, but I'm looking at what looks like revision number 3, showing it was issued today. Is that a misprint? Because if it isn't, then I think we haven't given 24-hour notice.
This was on yesterday's. House Bill 2323 was on yesterday's agenda, and pursuant to Senate rules, we gaveled it in yesterday to announce that it was being carried to today, and I believe then that we are within the...
Well, the revision 2, which is I have here, that's what my staff must have worked off of, is dated the 13th, but I don't see 2323 listed on there. I just want to make sure we're following protocol.
Senator Pozanski, if that's your today's agenda from yesterday, is that what you're saying? Revision 2 would be the agenda for today that was issued yesterday, correct? What this was on yesterday's, I'm sorry, this was on the June 13th agenda for public hearing and possible work session.
Okay.
Mr. Washington had to leave early, so we gaveled in just to say we were moving it to today.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. I'm Michael Washington. I'm chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And I'm here to testify in support of this bill and the importance of this bill, as Council Mollard indicated, that the current status of the bill doesn't allow the board enough time to have its psychologists evaluate the offender, then submit the report to the board, and then have the board schedule the hearing and then conduct that hearing with the offender as the statute currently reads. By way of history, in my research on this, these statutes, 144226 and 144228, in 1955, it was very clear that in 144226, certain offenders had to be given an examination every 2 years, and examining psychiatrists had to file the report within 60 days after the examination. And that report had to be made within 2 months of its considerations. So under those provisions, the 120 days could lapse between the examination and the parole consideration hearing. In 1981, the legislature amended 144226, and they added the phrase within 60 days prior to the parole consideration under 144228. And when that's read in context with 144228, it states that the dangerous offender should be given a complete mental, psychiatric, or psychological examination within 60 days prior to the parole consideration hearing. And as I earlier stated, the current reading of the statute has been interpreted to mean that the psychologist cannot take full advantage of the 60 days maximum that they are allowed by 144226 Section 1 to complete their report and submit that to the Board of Parole, and the Board cannot take full advantage of the 60-day maximum that's allowed by 144228 to receive that report and then schedule the hearing, to conduct a hearing with the offender.
Okay. Mr. Washington, to your knowledge, is there any opposition to this?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? So we will close the hearing on House Bill 2323 and open a work session on House Bill 2323. There are no amendments. Senator Starr.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2323 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2323 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Whitsitt, would you like to carry this? Okay, now we will open a public hearing. Let's do, is that yours? Mm-hmm. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2142. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2142 clarifies or specifies the circumstances under which corrections officers or other officials employed by the Department of Corrections may and may not use deadly physical force. The Engross version specifically makes it very clear that in situations of minimum or medium security, or particularly minimum security, that deadly physical force cannot be used to prevent escape from those standalone minimum security facilities or when a minimum custody classified inmate is at a co-located facility, meaning there's a minimum custody wing within a larger prison. Or when that minimum custody classified inmate is outside of the Department of Corrections institution assigned to work crew during transport or other supervised activities. The only time there's sort of an exception to that is if that minimum custody classified inmate is in a mixed population and something goes awry. And so that's what the bill does. There are dash A2 amendments. If those were adopted by the committee, it would require the officer to consider all types and amounts of physical force available, and it would require the officer to begin with the lowest type and amount that is reasonable under the circumstances. That dash A2 amendment is here at the request of the Western Prison Project.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Brzezinski.
Council, why wouldn't they already be required to start with the lowest level of reasonable force that's necessary as compared to starting an accelerated level?
Well, Senator Brzezinski, I think I will, to a certain extent, defer to Mr. Sugarman as to why he feels this amendment is necessary. I know there is some opposition to the amendment, and I think one of the reasons that certainly the Department of Corrections is concerned, I also received a letter from DPSST about that. They officers are trained already to use, there are levels of force that officers are trained to use. The concern is that there's this idea of a continuum of force, and codifying that statutorily has, if this A2 amendment sort of codifies that continuum of force situation, and there are concerns about that. I can tell you that case law, including the Supreme Court, requires an officer to use the amount of force that is reasonable under the totality of the circumstances, as does, from what I understand, the Department of Corrections administrative rule. So, I think they are already required to do that. So the question, I guess, is a policy one of the committee, okay, as to whether or not they'd adopt that amendment.
Okay, well, with that entree, we'll start out with Stan Cherniak from the Department of Corrections. Welcome to the committee, and if you would address the dash A2 amendment as well as the bill, that would be...
Chair Burdick and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, good afternoon. My name is Stan Cherniak. I'm the Assistant Director for operations for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and as articulated by Council Moed, we are here to talk about to clarify the Department of Corrections' authority to either use force or not use force in certain circumstances. Currently, Oregon statutes allow us to use potentially deadly force in the event of trying to prevent an escape from a correctional institution. Our own rules are much more conservative in that regard, in that we prohibit the use of deadly force in minimum custody institutions. What is not expressly authorized by Oregon statute is the authority to use potentially deadly force to quell a disturbance, to prevent loss of life, and to prevent escapes from outside transportation of inmate circumstances, such as taking inmates to court, outside hospital watch, and the like. As noted by counsel, committee counsel, the Department of Corrections has had conversations with Jeff Sugarman of the Western Prison Project regarding this bill. Mr. Sugarman has expressed a desire to put the Department of Corrections rule language concerning the continuum of force into statute. If desired by committee, based on advice from our legal counsel in the AG's office or Department of Justice, we recommend that the proposed language would read as follows, and I quote, "When circumstances reasonably allow, an employee shall consider all types and amounts of force available and begin with the lowest type and amount of, that is reasonable given the specifics of the situation," unquote. It would be atypical to put such rule language into statute because this is already in our own rule and is in fact our practice. Since this is our practice, we are not philosophically opposed to this amendment. However, the Department of Justice has raised the concern that this amendment may hold our officers criminally liable or civilly liable in a way that would not be held at this position if this provision remained only in rule. For the record, it is our intent that this amendment in no way changes our officers' current training and practice, and that it not prohibit them from using potentially deadly force in those circumstances for which they have been trained. Making clear in statute when deadly force is and is not permitted is important to the Department of Corrections, its staff, and the public, and inmates, and we respectfully request your support of House Bill 2142.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Why don't we have Mr. Sugarman come on up next and talk about the bill and the amendment.
Thank you.
And you'll be here if we have questions after the
Yes, Chair Burdick.
Thank you.
Jay Burdick, members of the committee, thank you. Jeff Sugarman with the Western Prison Project. The entire set of rules governing the use of deadly force in the prison system encompasses about 22 pages. We're not here suggesting that all of those rules be codified into law, but we do think that that overriding principle that the use of deadly force should be the last option and that other reasonable avenues should be explored is important to this legislation. What we're doing in 2142 is lifting certain pieces of these rules out and codifying them to statute and increasing the places and the opportunities where deadly force can be used. And what we're suggesting is that overriding principle that other options, wherever reasonable, should be considered before the use of deadly force is very appropriate to this legislation. And we would urge the committee to go on record, consistent with DOC's own rules, that the use of deadly force is always the last option. That's the purpose of including this amendment in 2142. Thank you very much.
And how do you respond to the concern about opening up more civil or criminal liability with this, with putting this in statute?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but it seemed to me that that Counsel Mawad was suggesting that because of the way the rules are written and the operations within the prison system, that could already happen if the use of deadly force were to occur. So I'm not sure that this would actually change anything in terms of the criminal and civil liability aspect of it, but it certainly would let the corrections officers and the entire department know that the use of deadly force should be the very last option that they consider.
Counsel, did you have a comment on that?
Well, Madam Chair, you know, I am not a civil lawyer either. I know that I think Ms. Botkin is here to specifically address some of those liability issues. What I can say is in talking with the DPSST, they are also concerned that this idea of when circumstances reasonably allow is sort of a difficult language for a jury to interpret, and I don't know that I would agree with Mr. Sugarman's assessment that if it's an administrative rule, then the liability is already there. I mean, I think there's a reasonableness issue, and who determines the reasonableness is... It makes it more difficult if you add the dash A to amendments, is my...
Makes it more difficult.
Makes it more difficult for the officers to... I think it would... I believe it would open them up to additional liability to add it to the statute, but I am not an expert on civil pleadings.
Okay, well, maybe others will testify. Pardon?
I'm listening.
Okay. All right, thank you. Okay, Ms. Botkin. Steve, do you want to come up too? Steve Dole? You're both on the same side of this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I represent the corrections officers who work in Oregon's prisons. Let's be very clear. We have not had a use of deadly force in probably 23 years or more. Stan and I, or Mr. Zerniak and I, were just trying to remember when the last deadly force case was, and we think it was somewhere around 1980, but it could have been before then. The reason that I say that is because the men and women who work in Oregon's prisons don't get up in the morning and think it's open season on inmates. This is not something they work to avoid this kind of a situation.
We're kind of running out of time, so if you could address the bill.
They're trained to avoid this situation, and they are trained both internally and at DPSST to use escalating force as necessary. The only time they would even consider using deadly force is when somebody's life is at risk. An officer, a visitor, another staff person, or another inmate. We don't want them sort of counting to 10, trying to decide what is at risk for them personally and professionally, where they are liable when they're making those decisions. We want them to make the decisions based on the situation they're confronted with.
So we're
okay with the bill. We just don't think the amendments, and we've talked with Mr. Sugarman, and he understands that there just isn't any way we can sign off on those amendments that may put our folks at risk, and especially when technology is moving so rapidly that there may be technological advances that would require that we change rules, and now it's in statute, so we'd have to wait for 2 years.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I'm really frustrated hearing what I'm hearing because I know every officer in this state are trained at DPSST on the continuum of force. I'm sitting on the police commission for Eugene. We walk through this. I sub the committee on use of force, and what I'm hearing doesn't make sense to me. They are trained to start at the lowest level that's reasonable and work up and come back down. What I'm hearing here today is that we don't want to hold people to what their training is. I'm really not grasping what we're trying to accomplish by not saying that they should use the training and maintain the level of force that's necessary, that's reasonable under those circumstances, and to think about whether they should be at level A, B, C, it's 1 through 7, if I remember correctly. I'm having a hard time here, Mary.
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, I don't think anybody's saying that, and I'm sorry if you think we are. What we're saying is it's already there. It's already in rule, and to hold our officers to a criminal and civil liability level.
They already are at civil and a criminal liability level based on what the rule is and what the requirement is.
Okay,
and
I'm just going on what the Attorney General said.
You look at 161, 265, it makes it very clear that they have the right, I mean, correctional facility officers have the right to use physical force, including deadly physical force, when and to the extent that is necessary to prevent the escape. And so they can use any level that is necessary.
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, we are responding to
the issues that were raised by the Attorney General.
And I have nothing in my file from the Attorney General. Do you have anything in writing from the Attorney General?
Just what the department has shared with us verbally.
If I could, Mr. Von Valkenburg is the Department of Justice attorney, and I think that their concerns are reflected here in the DOC's written testimony, in particular in the testimony Mr. Zerniak gave us. I think probably most of page 2 would reflect the Department of Justice's concerns. In other words, they would suggest this alternative language if the committee was going to amend this at all, and then furthermore, you see here it says specifically that the DOJ attorney raised a concern this amendment may hold our officers criminally or civilly liable in a way that they would not be held if the provision remains only in rule. So I think that's what Ms. Botkin is addressing and what Mr. Zerniak addressed. And Senator Pazansky, I have also gone to some training seminars, and the continuum of force idea, as I understand it from my brief conversations with Mr. Minnis when this amendment issue first came up, is that the DPSST is trying to move away from the entire concept of the continuum of force because it puts into someone's mind that an officer has to, in this situation where there is, let's just say, a riot going on, that the officer has to say, I am going to start with a verbal command, stop rioting. Next, I am going to use my baton. And so I think the idea is that they train the officers to assess the situation and use that level of force, which is specifically required for that situation, instead of requiring them to go through the mental...
If they don't use the mentality to determine what level of force is appropriate, they're never going to get there. And the reality is the way they are trained is they start at the level that's necessary at that point in time based on what they are faced with. They don't start and go A, B, C, D, and up and back down till they find the right one.
I think, Senator Pazansky, we are actually in agreement here. I think the idea is, by putting into language this idea, this continuum of force or level of force idea, potentially what's happening is a jury is going to be instructed to believe, or that there's this idea in mind that a jury is going to think that the officer had to go through those, that an officer had to have said, if level one is, I believe, verbal command, for example, that the officer would have had to have given the verbal command before the officer could go to level two. And that is not how officers are trained. My understanding from my conversations with DPSST is that the officers are trained to respond reasonably to the situation, but if the officer walks in and there's a knife to a hostage's throat and they have 3 seconds to react to that, they need to react with the appropriate level of force instead of starting at verbal.
And Madam Chair, if I may, counsel, if there was a suit filed for misuse of force or abuse of their use of force, they would go through the continuum and would define what each of those levels are and why that person, that officer, started at the level they did for the situation they were faced with at that point in time. That's exactly what the whole lawsuit would be. We dealt with this in Eugene.
Maybe we're not understanding one another perfectly, but I don't think we're actually in disagreement. I don't.
But the question is whether to put it in the statute.
That's right.
And
so. I don't disagree with the thing that Senator Pazansky has said, philosophically or professionally. I don't disagree. I think you're absolutely right, Madam Chair. The question is whether or not you put it in statute, and I'm just responding to what the Attorney General has informed us.
Okay. Let's hear from Mr. Dole.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Dole from Crime Victims United. We are also opposed to placing this in statute because we believe that the rules are an evolving issue, and that we don't want to see this thing have to wait from legislature to legislature 2 years at a time if there are changes that need to be made based on evolving technologies and other issues. This we're very concerned about the corrections officers, but there's other people in the prisons to be concerned about: the health care workers, the cafeteria and canteen workers, the administration, the inmates themselves and their families, and quite frankly, you and I. We've all been in the prisons, or most of us. I know I've been in there several times in the last 10 years for various reasons. And we want to make sure that when civilians, if you will, are visiting the prisons, that we have complete protection, that these people aren't hesitating too long to determine what they have to do in a situation. The other issue is this, is that we're talking about in-community and transport issues, and that involves people on the street. Let's make no mistake in the fact that 67% of our prison population today are violent offenders. 22% are repeat property offenders, and about 11% are behavioral, drug offenses, weapons offenses, etc. With that high percentage of violent offenders, we've got a different type of prison population that we're dealing with today, and we want to make sure that, again, that with evolving changes in standards and technology, that we don't think this should be something that's in a hard and fast statute. And I thank you for your time.
Committee. Okay. Yeah,
Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Whitson?
One quick question on your minimum security prisons. Do very violent offenders ever find their way to the minimum security prison before they're released?
Madam Chair, perhaps Mr. Zerniak would be more appropriate to answer that. I can try. I know that it is possible for a violent offender to earn their way into a minimum security prison through, you know, appropriate and good behavior. I mean, our goal is to reform folks. And so it would be our hope that prior to release that they're not any longer very violent, and so they could be placed in a minimum security facility. But Mr. Zerniak could tell you for sure who is placed where.
Zerniak, did you want to add to that?
Chair Burdick and Senator Whitsett, at the time that an inmate is assessed for minimum custody placement, we go through a pretty rigorous process, and if our determination is that they are in any way a danger to the community, they will not be placed in a minimum custody institution.
Yeah, Chair. Let's say you have someone who has been incarcerated for murder, and they had a 20-year sentence, and they've served 18 years of their sentence, and are you saying that they will be maintained in a maximum security prison until they're released, or will you step it down?
Chair Burdick and Senator Whitsett, there are certain categories, and I believe murder is one, that you would not be in a minimum custody institution. I'd have to get the whole classification system out to take a look at that and give you an exact answer, but that we go through all kinds of different dynamics. For one thing, you have to be within 3 years of release. You can't have had any major misconduct within a certain period of time. And I'd have to get all the particulars of the classification system to tell you exactly which crimes would not ever be eligible to go to minimum custody. And there would certainly be some probably that at some point in their criminal history had some violence on their record that could work their way into minimum custody, but that would be pretty rarely a rare case. And when it does happen, those, again, are thoroughly assessed to be a good risk.
Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski?
One follow-up on that. Is there never a time that you assign an inmate who may be classified at a higher level to a lower security based on their job skills?
Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski, we would not do that if we felt that the inmate was a danger to anybody, particularly to society. That is our number one mission in the Department of Correction, is in fact to protect the public.
I understand that, but I also understand that there are people that have committed more violent crimes that have certain job skills in their training that have actually been used at minimum secure facilities because of those abilities that they have.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, we're going to We're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2142, and we're going to, I'm going to bring this bill back. I want to mull it over a little bit on this amendment matter, and we'll talk to committee members individually. Now we will open I think actually given the short time, we will move House Bill 2142 to tomorrow's agenda. Is that the appropriate time for this?
That's fine. Hopefully my staff is listening. 2142 will be on
2142 tomorrow. Up tomorrow, Senator Prozanski's staff. Mm-hmm. House Bill 2142.
One.
Tomorrow's meeting
is at 1 o'clock.
Is at 1 o'clock, the regular time.
And now we're scheduled to go, I had it on good authority, we're scheduled to go 4 hours tomorrow.
6 hours, Senator Walker. We are a hard-working committee. I think right now we will open a work session on House Bill 2221. I think we can get this out of the way pretty quick. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2221 is a bill that comes to you from the DOJ. It establishes a child abuse multidisciplinary intervention program in the Department of Justice. This bill was heard originally on June 2nd, and I was asked to determine whether there was a conflict, if there was conflicts with other bills, and there's not. During that search for conflicts, one error was pointed out. There's apparently a reference to a public meetings law that should have been a reference to a public records law. And so that change was made in the B4 amendments, which you have before you. So again, there were no conflicts noticed or noted in this bill, so it can move forward. And the committee should adopt the B4 amendments to make that correction.
Okay. Let's see. We got four of us loyal troopers left. If we are in work session, unless somebody has any concerns with the dash B4 or the bill itself, we can move forward. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move the dash B4 amendments to House Bill 2221.
Senator Starr has moved the dash B4 amendment to House Bill 2221. Is there any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2221 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2221 as amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
We will be most grateful. Okay, now that we have a full contingent here, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2306. Council. Wait, before we leave that, Senator Beyer, did you want to be recorded as a vote on House Bill 2221 since you just left briefly? We just passed that out.
You just passed it out?
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how there could not be a fiscal in the bill, but it says no fiscal. I'm just wondering how.
We are not in work session on that bill, but would you just confirm that we don't have a fiscal?
Yeah, there's not a fiscal, Senator Beyer. I haven't spoken with LFO. I don't know the exact reasons behind the issuance of the statement.
Put them down as an excuse, whatever I need.
Okay. Mark Senator Beyer is excused. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2306. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2306 comes to you from the Oregon Collectors Association. It was heard in this committee on May 31st. This is the bill that makes unmarried parents liable for the expenses of their children. During the committee, there was an issue that was raised, a concern regarding children who are deemed a majority due to themselves having children and then the parents being liable for those children. Specifically, maybe there was examples raised of where that child may move out, incur expenses, and then whether this bill would make the parents liable for those expenses. For that reason, the -A7 amendments delete provisions that make parents liable for the expenses of children who are deemed to have attained majority to address that issue. There's also another aspect or another part to the A7 amendments that create a task force on children's access to health care, and they direct this task force to serve as an advisory committee to the Oregon Health Policy Commission and study children's access to health care. That those amendments go on to direct the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research to conduct an assessment of children's access to health care and requires the office to prepare a final assessment report that incorporates input from the task force. Sunsets the task force on the convening of the next regular biennial legislative session. I believe Representative Nolan is here to speak further on that aspect of the amendments.
We have three people signed up: Jim Marquis, Tina Kotek, and Lisa Tressel. And Representative Nolan, you said you did not want to come up, and you're more than welcome if you would like to come up.
Madam Chair, I smell a bill that had a relating clause.
It was a nice little bill, Senator.
Observer from UG. I'm shopping for the same thing.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, since I did not sign up, I won't take much of your time. And, in fact, there are two other people to speak to the second portion of the amendment who probably can give you a better perspective on it than I can. But I will simply say that...
You have to give your name for the record.
Representative Mary Nolan, Southwest Portland. I will simply say that, in essence, the amendment, the portion of the amendment that I'm interested in, creates only a public forum for discussion of work already being done by the Office of Health Policy and Research, and brings in interested parties like businesses, like insurance companies, like advocates for children's health, to work together to help guide the work of the Oregon Health Policy Commission and the Office of Health Policy Research. We've worked very carefully to coordinate this both with work that office is already doing, so that there will be no additional fiscal cost for this amendment. And secondly, we are also aware of efforts to take a bigger look at health care generally, and we have placed a marker, if you will, with legislative council, so that this will not duplicate any other effort that's going on to look at access to health care more generally. If, in fact, a bigger look is approved, then this task force will be subsumed under that bigger look and will not duplicate that effort or go off in a separate direction. As I said, Lisa Tressel from Associated Oregon Industries and Tina Kotek from Children First can actually give you their perspective from kind of how they would work together to try to bring something to the next 2007 Legislative Assembly. But I'll take questions if there are any.
Thank you. Questions of Representative Nolan? Senator Barr.
Thank you. I'm curious. I mean, there seems to be a relating to clause issue here. I mean, you got relating to liability of parents for expenses of child, mm-hmm. and you're putting in task force dealing with children's health.
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, it is a very focused task force, and it is specifically looking at health care and the expenses for health care of dependent children of working parents, and that falls within the area that you're looking at in this bill. It's talking about the health care expenses of dependent children of working parents.
And Legislative Council told you it fit within the relating clause?
They drafted it, Madam Chair.
They usually let us know. I know this from personal experience when there's a problem. Okay.
We've all been there. Madam Chair, I really appreciate your attention to this and your inviting us to bring this forward. Thank you.
I appreciate you bringing this forward. It sounds like a good one. I do have a note from Bruce Goldberg, from the Office of Health Policy, and they say they are fine with this and have worked with Representative Nolan on it. Other questions? Mr. Marquis, for the other part of the amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. I testified at the earlier hearing on this bill, and I want to thank Senator Whitsitt for raising some issues that, frankly, we hadn't thought about. It was certainly never our intention to create unintended consequences, and I believe that portions of this bill would have created some unintended consequences. So we ask staff, council, with the chair's permission, to draft the Dash 5 amendments, which delete any references to RS 109-112, and that is the statute that under present law says a person who becomes a parent is no longer a minor. Our original bill would have had parents remain liable for the expenses of that child after they were a parent, and we've deleted those sections from the bill. We're going to take another look at that during the interim, but we want to be very cautious because I think Senator Whitsitt pointed out quite pointedly that there were some unintended consequences with that. So we would ask that the committee adopt those amendments to the bill and move the bill forward. We have no position for or against the task force. The Dash 7 amendments do contain, in addition to the task force, those changes that we had asked for in 109-112 to get rid of that section that was troublesome. Representative Nolan came and talked to us about these other amendments. We have absolutely no problem using this bill for those amendments. And I believe that council did okay the relating clause issue, and I think the language in the Dash 7s that talks about studying the extent to which parents' liability for their children's health care expenses impacts the children's access to health care brings the nexus, apparently, that was required for that. So with that, I think that I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker. Just one. Mr. Marquis referenced the A5 amendment, and Senator Whitson and I were scrambling looking for an A5, and council has told us that the A5 is incorporated in the A7.
That's correct.
Yes. The A5s were originally drafted to address the concern that I talked about. They are incorporated into the 7s, yes.
Okay.
So if you adopt the 7s, you would
do what we whole shebang.
Yes.
The A5s have been vastly improved by the content of the A7s.
Even though we never saw it before.
Yeah, okay.
The A5s were incomplete. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Yeah. Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, I have in my notes here that this bill would create an unequal liability for parents. Married parents would be liable versus parents who aren't married but live together who would not be liable.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, current law is unequal in that regard, and this bill actually fixes that. Under current Oregon law, 108-040, commonly called the Family Expense Statute, makes husbands and wives equally responsible for the expenses of the family and the education and care of the children, but only if they're married. People who live together and have children together and live as a family unit don't share that kind of liability for the expenses of their children. And this bill creates a new statute that parallels the family expense statute for married people, for those people who choose to live together and not be married but have children, so that the two parents are equally responsible for the debts incurred for the expenses and education of the children, just as if they were married.
Okay.
Did I confuse the issue more? Does that answer your question, Senator Byer?
No, actually, I mean, okay.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two more people signed up, Tina Kotek and Lisa Trussell. And the briefer you can keep the comments, the more likely we can deal with Amber Alert before adjournment.
Good Welcome. Afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, Policy Director with Children First for Oregon. I will keep it brief. I'm good at that. We support the -A7 amendments because sometimes you need to put a little fire under the issue around access to health care for children. There is existing work going on with the Office of Health Policy and Research. There's the Oregon Health Policy Commission. And I think what's great about how this task force and this amendment is written is really saying, let's just get a group together of business folks, advocates, insurance industry individuals to look at this issue, to keep the conversation going in the interim. And I think it's a very positively written amendment. I don't think it's going to incur any extra cost, but it will put some focus on a very important issue in the state, the fact that many of our children do not have access to health care. They're uninsured. Even if they are insured, they don't have access to health care. So we're very supportive of the amendment. Thank you.
Ms. Trussell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, here to offer our support for the -7 amendments for this bill as well, and for the reasons that have already been cited. But the cost of health care is a huge issue for our members, and we're finding more and more as the premium cost increases that many of the employees who are required to pay their share of the dependent coverage are having to drop coverage on those dependents. And getting children covered under a public-private partnership into the group health plan, frankly, we think has positive impacts on the cost of the premium. So we'd encourage your support.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay, we're going to close. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2306. Open a work session on House Bill 2306.
Madam Chair, I move -7 amendments to 2306.
Senator Starr has moved the -7 amendments to House Bill 2306. Discussion. Senator Whitsitt.
Senator Burdick, we haven't had time to study the -7 amendments.
Okay.
It's a completely new bill. I can't support that.
Okay. Other discussion? Are you going to object, Senator Barr?
Not to the Zethans. I'll just wait until we get to the bill, I guess.
Okay. All right. Are you going to object to the amendments?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt objects to the amendments. Senator Byer does not. Right. Adopted. Senator Stark.
I will move House Bill 2306 is amended to the Senate floor committee pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2306 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
He's got a hand up.
Senator Burdick, like Senator Byer, I have a problem with the relating clause. I wonder if there's a fiscal on this. I lack time to study the issue, and I was not going to support it on that basis. I'm not saying it's a good bill or a bad bill. I'm saying I haven't had time to look at it.
Okay, well, maybe we can get you back on the floor. Dale, would you please take the roll?
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo? Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
4 ayes, 2 nays, and 1 excuse.
Okay, that passes. I will carry that bill.
Madam Chair?
Senator Barr?
Like Senator Whitsitt, I may be supporting this bill on the floor, but I just...
I appreciate that. And it is reaching the end here, so my apologies for urgent action here. I would like to take up this next bill on House Bill 2730. Public hearing, Council.
House Bill 2730A comes to you from the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. This bill provides civil immunity for radio or television broadcasters who participate in the AMBER plan. It provides that civil immunity does not apply for intentional misconduct or gross negligence.
Okay, Council, I think I distinctly remember having a hearing on this before.
We did have a hearing on this, and I think you did not take it to a work session because a lot of the members were gone.
Right, and so I think this was misposted today, so I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 27. Do we have amendments?
There are no amendments.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2730 and open a work session on House Bill 2730.
Senator Chair, I move House Bill 2730 to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2730 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who'd like to carry this?
I'd like to carry it.
Senator Pisanski will carry it. It has to do with traffic. Of course you'll carry it.
It's Amber is what I work
with. Amber, okay. We had a group of young women walk in while we were talking. Can I hazard a guess that you're from Girls State? All right, I see nods. We were hoping to have the timing correctly so that you could be here to see House Bill 2221 pass through the committee, but it did pass through the committee and it will go to the Senate floor. And Senator Walker will be enlightening the Senate about the content of that bill. So I appreciate your coming and we're glad to have you. Hope you're having a good day. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.